Great. Thank you all for coming today. I'm delighted you're here. My name is John Hamry. I'm the president here at CSIS. I stole the brass ring away from Vincent Sabatier, who was going to introduce Admiral Lautenbacher. I wasn't supposed to do this, but I couldn't resist, and I wanted to come down and just greet an old friend and to welcome here to CSIS and to welcome all of you. This is going to be a very good session. You know, when I was a kid, I was in my hometown. I grew up in a very little town called Clark, South Dakota, and was in the marching band. And when you ask people, what's the most important thing in a marching band, you know, and most people think of always is the trumpets or the trombones, the big brassy stuff. That's not. It's the bass drum. Because the bass drum is what keeps everybody moving in place, okay? Now, I use that as a very innocent metaphor to say that there are some elements of the federal government that are so fundamental that they're like the bass drum. They don't get much attention. They aren't flashy. Matter of fact, a lot of people don't even know about them. All the trumpets are blaring away and all that. But there's something that kind of keeps the government moving forward. And that's no, of course. And I said this to Admiral Lautenbacher. I think he's heading up one of the most important and least appreciated offices of the federal government. And I mean that as a compliment, because it takes someone of Connie's deep commitment to the quality of government to take on this job after having served in a very distinguished career for almost 40 years. You know, as he said, his wife asked, "Why the hell are you still doing this?" And I can say, I can understand that, because he certainly has earned, with his enormous and creative service, a more comfortable and richer life now. But he continues to serve the country in this enormously important role. It isn't understood very well. Americans do not understand the importance of this agency. And so I think it's unusually important for us citizens to know that someone of his caliber and talent is willing to continue to serve, because I think he understands how important this agency is and how much we depend on these assets in space that very few people know about. Of course, there's a lot more to NOAA than just the space segment, but we're here today. We wanted to hear from him about the space segment because of our efforts. So I think, Vincent, do you want to say the formal introduction to Admiral Lautenbacher? I just had to come and say thank you for coming and welcome an old friend, and thank him for continuing to serve the country. Let me turn it back to you.
Thank you very much, John, for this kind introduction. So I would like to add some details to the career of Admiral Lautenbacher, who has been appointed head of NOAA in December 01. As you know, he has a very technical background, as I would say. First, he's a graduate of the U.S. Naval Academy and holds a MS and a PhD from Harvard University in applied mathematics. And as John said, he retired after 40 years of service in the Navy. And we are very happy to have Admiral Lautenbacher with us today, because, as you know, we've been at CSIS, we've been involved in space for about 3-4 years now, mainly promoting human space exploration, global space exploration. And one of our focus is to promote global governance for space exploration. And as you know, Admiral Lautenbacher has promoted and was instrumental in creating in 03 the Global Earth Observation System of Systems, GEOS, which is a multilateral structure, which includes now some 60 countries, maybe 66?
69.
To study system Earth. So that was a very bold move and a very bold initiative, and it's as well a very original governance model, which is meant, obviously, to coordinate the international efforts on global change. And some could argue it could be the future for space exploration as well. As you all know, because you're all specialists, space specialists, yeah, you all know that the amount of environmental data coming from space is overwhelming. And the civilian applications of remote sensing satellites are both numerous and, unfortunately, as John said, unknown from the public. So NASA is usually involved in developing satellites, remote sensing satellites, for civilian application, but NOAA usually operates them and has a critical role operating those satellites. Currently, the U.S. is experiencing some significant programmatic difficulties in this field, and I think it's a good time to try to create a support for this activity. So, Admiral, the floor is yours. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you very much. It's indeed a great privilege and a pleasure to be here. I'm certainly honored by Dr. Hamry being here and my colleague Vincent, we've worked with for the last 5 or 6 years. And I relate to the bass drum story because my son played the bassoon in the band. And, of course, you don't march with a bassoon. So during the football season, he had to play the bass drum. So he had two fans watching him. That's all. Myself and my wife went out and watched him play the bass drum. So, and he was absolutely necessary. So it's a good thing. A very short paid political announcement. The importance of NOAA, before we get into the space side of this. NOAA has been around in pieces for 200 years. It is basically the first scientific agency in the United States government created by Thomas Jefferson. It's called the Survey of the Coast. And Thomas Jefferson and the Congress realized that they could not get trade and economic value into this country without being able to tell ships' captains where the ports were, where the coasts were, how deep the harbors were. And, of course, you recall that Jefferson sent Lewis and Clark out with a marvelous number of scientific instruments and directions to do more than just look at the territory, but to figure out what was going on there. So I would like to give to, in recognition of our 200th year celebration, a coin, commemorative coin, to John for his service here at CSIS, and to Vincent for inviting me to come here to talk to you this afternoon. So thank you. And again, 200 years of NOAA, the first scientific agency in the United States government. Ah, okay, now something will happen here. Do I have to hit something? Next slide, maybe? Yeah, there it goes. Okay. This is. I love technology. It sometimes works, sometimes doesn't. I hope everybody can see that. The charts are a part of the presentation. I will be talking, but looking at some of the pictures are worthwhile. You see a picture that tries to make sort of a medical analogy to looking at the Earth. If you were able to give the Earth a continuous MRI, as we go into a hospital, we expect people to examine us from top to bottom. We expect to see running lines. We expect to see all this correlation of information on our systems. If you were able to do that and you were able to bring it down to your desktop computer and you're able to work all of the issues that surround the complexities of our globe and bring it to the point where policymakers understood what was going on. They had consistent information where average citizens could go and look at this and get to it. You would have a marvelously much better functioning world. There's no doubt about it. That's a promise of a global Earth observing system of systems with the technology that we have today. And I would like to talk about this in terms of security, because CSIS is very much focused on security and international work in bringing nations closer together for peaceful reasons, but it is more than just a scientific experiment. It's a scientific expedition. It is, in fact, critical for environmental security, for societal benefits, and for economic security as well. And I guess one last caveat is that I realize I probably have a mixed audience. I have some people who are what I would call the usual suspects. I see a few of them sitting in the front row that heard me talk about this before, so you're not going to see a whole lot new, but maybe a little bit, and people who maybe you're not familiar with this area at all, so I'm trying to provide some introduction to it. So let's talk about Earth observations, and this is an important justification, in my view, for space, for our whole presence in space. If we are not watching this planet, which is the lifeboat upon which we all float and are not about to get off very soon, then what are we doing in space? Space can be very important from, this is the only way to observe the globe in total and view it from remote areas of the Arctic and the Antarctic to the rainforests of Brazil. But why Earth observations? First of all, prediction. You'd like to know what's going to happen. If you have a hurricane coming, if you have a natural disaster coming, even if you have a man-made disaster coming, you'd like to be able to predict it. If you could predict what the stock market would be doing in 6 months, you'd all be rich. If you could predict what the Earth's environment would look like in 6 months, you also could be very rich, because there's a lot depends on our economy and society on what the status of the Earth's environment is. So there's a prediction value here. We want to know what happens. Prevention, we'd like to prevent some of the bad things that can happen to us. Having information up front from Earth observations can do that. We'd like to be prepared. Preparedness for things that we may not be able to mitigate, but things that we can deal with if we know up front they're going to happen, like a major hurricane. And in the end, security, things like energy security, food security, planning security of what I would call infrastructure security, all depend on understanding the Earth that we live on and being able to observe it and provide the scientific extrapolations into the future. So what are we talking about in observations? First of all, we're talking more than space. You have up here five examples of observations that we take today and a little bit for the future. So you see on your left the GOES, meaning geostationary, a long-range picture of the Earth, which shows an El Nino condition in the Pacific Ocean. And that they're usually measured in degrees off of the average temperature at that particular time in the ocean. And you may not be able to read the numbers, which are not necessary, but it shows it's very hot along the equator. And that we can talk more about El Nino conditions later if you'd like. But this gives you a picture from space. But in order to understand that and appreciate it and to predict an El Nino, you cannot just use the space picture. You must have information from the Earth. You must have information from the ocean and underneath the ocean. Remember, we can't see into the ocean from space. We can see the surface and maybe a little bit into it, but basically we must observe the ocean from the ocean. And El Nino conditions depend upon what's going on in the structure of the ocean from the surface, at least in the first 500 or 600 feet. So you need that space picture. You need the kinds of observing platforms, and I just want to tell you what they are because they're interesting ones. There's a tide gauge station there. Does this work? Yeah. Water level station. We have a series of tide gauge stations. Tide gauge meaning that it takes into account longer wave types of phenomena, not little waves that crash along the shore and little ripples, but longer waves. So tide gauge stations are very important to us because they give us sea level and sea level rise, sea level change. You have the latest in technology that we've just put in the water in the Indian Ocean under the with the help of USAID. This is what's called a dark tube buoy. It's the first one in the Indian Ocean to report teletsunamis, basically tsunamis that are so strong that they can they propagate across the Indian Ocean. The same problem we had. We've now corrected the problem that we had with the tsunami of 2 years ago in Indonesia, because we now have a buoy in the water and there are plans for several others. And this is the latest technology produced by the PMEL, the Pacific Marine Environmental Laboratory, that does that work for NOAA. This is the coming technology, UAVs. UAVs, we can send them into the middle of a hurricane because we don't have to worry about manned airplanes and the vulnerability of manned aircraft and the pilots. We have ways of using UAVs now, sort of intermediary between surface monitoring systems and satellites. So there will be times when you could use Global Hawks to track a hurricane, for instance. So there's a lot of value to using unmanned air vehicles to collect atmospheric data. This is really an interesting one that you don't think about, but this is a loaded container ship coming into one of our major ports. I believe this is Long Beach. And this is an air gap sensor. This is one of the monitors that we put on bridges in order to be able to tell how much clearance. because many of these ships are loaded so full to the top that a foot or two makes a big difference. Now, we can do pretty well on tides and wind conditions and current conditions, but it really is nice to know exactly what that clearance is that you're going to have when you go underneath that ship if you've got multi-million dollar loads here on board. So these are air gap sensors and are now which are being put on bridges around our major ports. So that's another interesting piece of the observing system. So it's a whole family of observing systems that are out there, space and land-based. They're out there today. Okay. Why is that important? They impact society. On the left-hand side, you see what we use the term supply and demand, but you're looking at energy, basically, here. If you're looking at the water cycle, you'd like to know what the snowpack looks like and what the runoff looks like in order to, for the western part of our nation, depends quite a bit, not exclusively, but depends on hydropower. They also need it for drinking water. Water is probably the most important commodity in the world today. A third of the world does not have clean, safe drinking water. A third of our country is normally in drought at any one time, and we have to know how to manage that. So understanding that makes a difference for our water supplies, for irrigation, for power, and for sustenance and agriculture. On the demand side, you look at how much energy do you need, and the environmental conditions that you have determine what that is. Our energy companies today use our information, use NOAA's information, use private sector information to figure out how much they should store up in terms of fuel, what the demand loads will be because of the temperature on any given day, and what availability they have to various energy sources. So demand calculations, and that's just one example. Security. If you look at things like droughts and floods, and this is an interesting one. This shows a major cargo ship aground because they didn't have the right information. This is they actually did get this ship off the sandbar there, but it took weeks. And in this world of just-in-time inventorying, you can't afford that. You have to have the right information at the right time of what's going on with the topography as well as the water situation. Tsunami hazard zones, obviously getting away from natural disasters is important. You need to have ways to do that. That's security of your town or your region. You have floods and droughts that affect food security. Food security is very important. It's important people go to war over for its food security. Understanding how to manage the systems that help produce food, given your understanding of the environment, are very important. Forest fires, a huge problem in many parts of the world, depending on where the droughts are. Forest fires, remember Indonesia was on fire a couple of years ago. Our West, it turns into a flaming inferno every couple of years with droughts. And probably one of the biggest things, security, health security. When you look at, you see a sample of potentially malaria or other vector diseases that can be carried by a mosquito, but there are enormous percentages of health effects that we have today are caused by vector diseases, are caused by carriers. When you start combining the medical, the pathology, biological information with the physical and the chemical that we can produce from satellite pictures and from ground-based sensors, you're going to tell an awful lot about how diseases are transmitted. You could today, if you wanted to, set up a system that would track bird flu. Now, we don't have enough people out there with imagination to do this, but it's coming. We can work on malaria. There is a system now that tells you where you're going to have malaria and then where you should apply your money. Now, this is important. I got that last point, is that where should you invest? If you do not have an understanding of the environment, how do you plan the kinds of agriculture you ought to plant, where you ought to drill a well, where you ought to build a road? When I was at the World Summit in Johannesburg a few years ago in 2002, one of the principal or most important talks that I attended, it wasn't a talk, presentation, had 11 African countries praising information that they'd gotten basically from NOAA, NASA, from CNES and ESA, from European Space Agency, for 30 years track of what their countries look like, combined with ground-based databases and county managers, city planners got up and said, we never knew what to do. Now we know where the flood zones are. We know what the drought cycles look like. We know where we should drill the next well. You've got to keep this information coming. And that spurred the idea for the G8 to begin this global Earth-observing system of systems. But there's enormous value in security. And these one African nation after another got up, these individuals, praising this idea of getting the right kinds of environmental information to them so that even if you have a few resources, you ought to be able to invest them wisely. In my view, that's one of the biggest problems we have with foreign aid today. We don't have people investing the money wisely. If they understood what was going on in their countries, it would be a lot easier. And you had visibility on it, it wouldn't all end up in the Swiss bank accounts. It might end up in places where it counts. Anyway, that's another lecture. Okay, I'll let some of the other experts talk about that. But critical decisions. How do we make decisions? The environment and the economy are one. You can't talk about one without talking about the other. You've got to deal with it. Here's a picture of our favorite predator in for salmon, just waiting at the top of the cliff here for these guys to go up and form his dinner. But we also need that water, and we need salmon. But we need the water for hydropower. How do we make those decisions? And I can assure you that I spend a lot of time getting beat up by both sides on this issue in the Northwest. How do we protect salmon and how do we protect hydropower? Land use, agriculture, urban versus agriculture. What kinds of agriculture? Where should the urban developments be? And this gets into the issue of should New Orleans been rebuilt? Should we have been rebuilt or should we build New Orleans back the same way it was before? I don't want to get into that. It's a political question, but think about it. This is the kind of information that's really important. Okay, how do we do that? For those of you that understand NOAA, this is very basic. But we have two sets of satellite systems that we operate for NOAA satellites. We have the GOES system, which are geostationary satellites. Remember, they're 22,400 miles or so above the equator. They sit in one place so that they can be constantly watching. They're wonderful monitors for sudden storms, for the formation and tracking of hurricanes. There are two of them, one at 75 degrees west, one at 135 degrees west. That goes 11, goes 12. And we try to, provided our procurement systems function as they ought to, have one spare. Now it goes 13. It's at 140 degrees west, and obviously it stands by to move in case one of these others fail. Fortunately, GOES 10 is still operating, and we've been able to move that to 60 degrees west, and South America is taking advantage of it now. So we are sharing with South America ability to monitor from space very carefully our weather systems. We're going to have a big announcement at the Brazilian embassy tomorrow for GOES systems for the Americas and GIOS for the Americas. Now that we have polar orbiting satellites, there's two primary satellites. They're called POES, polar orbiting operational satellites system. It's a 2 p.m., 10 a.m. They obviously have much shorter. They're 500 miles or so above the Earth, very close. They provide about 90% of the data for our weather models, which is a lot of people don't understand. It's an enormous contribution to lots of these nice pictures you see on TV at night. We don't create the nice pictures, but we give the pride the data that allows the software manufacturers to give it to the news people at night that give you the weather. But these satellites provide most of that information. They've been in continuity of operation since early 60s. This system, this geostationary system, has been in operation since 1974. An interesting point is that because we don't, our acquisition systems, as I know Dr. Hamry is intimately familiar, sometimes tend to cost a little bit more than projected and aren't delivered on time. So actually in 1991 to 94, we had to borrow a satellite from the Europeans to keep our system going. We now have agreements with both the Europeans and the Japanese. We lent the Japanese a satellite 2 years ago to keep going until they could launch one. So we're now looking at what I would call a very robust system for international sharing of assets because they're so important to everyone. And every nation sort of is in the same situation. We have one of a kind. We don't have you know, we don't have lots of backups. There's not three deep up there. I might mention that we also run the satellites for the military. For those of you not familiar, NOAA is the cheapest operator of meteorological satellites, and we run what's called the DMSP system, which is the Air Force and DoD system. It's run over here at Suitland in our satellite operations facility. It's a brand new building. It's a Star Wars kind of thing. For those of you that are interested, at some point, it's worthwhile seeing. Next generation. I know we have at least a few people here that are interested in that. The NPOS system, and you can see where it's going. This is the history of the instruments that you're looking at from space, and I won't go through the alphabet soup, but this is two bands, essentially. This is six channels or bands, and the one that we're testing now and about to launch in a year or two will have 22 channels. So we're going to be able to get much more information. They're going to be much more. Here they're just showing a difference in resolution, but you're going to be able to look at much more refinement in the content of the atmosphere and in the sounding, or what we call profiles, from the surface to the stratosphere. And that information will be invaluable for characterizing much more of what the chemical content, what the moisture content is of our atmosphere, and give us much better forecasts of the future. So that's coming. It's called NPOS. It's another subject of a lecture all to itself, because it's one of those systems that's not meeting its goals in terms of time and money. So we're working on it, but it'll be there eventually. We haven't had one of these systems which has come in on cost anyway. So it's part of the progress in space, I guess. But it's still important. This shows you. I want to move from the nation now to international, so you can look at this. You see on the geostationary orbit there, basically the nations of the world have covered the entire globe. And we have an organization that allows the sharing of that information. So you can come to our command center and you can see a full global picture of the weather from geostationary satellites at any given time. You have it covered basically by the United States, by Europe, by India, by Russia, by China, and by Japan. They all have geostationary satellites. They all contribute to the system. And it's a distributed system of systems, because each country operates its own command center, yet they're tied together. So we can shift the information and provide a consistent picture from any nation's command center. Our object here in GEOS is to make sure that is available to everyone, whether they're a developed nation or not. And you see, the polar orbit is not as well populated. The United States has been doing this for quite a while. China has a polar orbiting satellite. By the way, that was one of the ones they shot down when they were doing their space test. They're an old one. So there's another issue of security that comes up, another aspect which I won't go into at this point, but I'm sure it's of interest to some of you. And the Europeans have just gotten in the business. They have put up what they call MEDOP-A, which is actually a partnership between the United States and Europe, an international partnership. It's a European satellite, and it has a number of United States instruments on it. So it's a joint orbit, and it is providing information in both directions, information that's useful both domestically and across the river at the Pentagon. So it's a very, very interesting development, and they have two more of these that have been built and ready to go. So this is a long-range investment by the Europeans. In this area, and we expect to see. Those are the only. Now there are other folks that have what I would call R&D satellites in polar orbit, but these are the operational satellites that are in polar orbit. And remember, the Air Force has the DMSP, which is a military satellite that's also in polar orbit. But this is the place where you get the bulk of your information, and it is the coming area, polar orbits, in terms of building international relations and international agreements. I just came back from Japan, and Japan is very interested in joining the collaboration that we have with the Europeans on these polar orbiting satellites. They see MEDOP as a success. We talked about a number of ideas of trading instruments, providing U.S. instruments on Japanese satellites, or providing interchange of data from these polar orbiting satellites, and it was a very useful conversation. I think we're moving in the right. And the Indians, we've had many conversations with because of our cooperative agreement with them in space. Okay, let me move on. I want to point out a couple of things that are, I think, very important to realize. When you talk about the globe and you see pictures from space, oh, they're wonderful, and it makes the globe look just like a little ball, and it's a toy, it's just really neat, but who cares? What you really care about is what happens, what's happening in Washington. Did you all like the snow this weekend? You care about what's going on locally. Local, it's local issues that drive the problem. But you can't do that without, in our environmental systems, they're connected. You must work observations on a global sense. So we talk about observing globally, and then you have to model regionally, because global models don't have enough fidelity. And they don't. Our computers today don't give you a small, fine enough mesh size, as we call it, or increments on which you can compute. You have to model regionally, which we're getting better. The latest IPCC reports that are out are much better regionally. They have regional models involved in it. But when it comes down to it, that information has to come down and it's act locally. On the other hand, it takes to refine what's going on here. You have to observe locally. You have to have those tide gauge stations that I showed. You have to have those buoys in the water, in the ocean. You've got to have the UAVs in the air picking up the local conditions. And again, model regionally and act globally. Again, pointing back the other way, if you can bring these regional models together, and this is a good one. For those of you that don't recognize this, I spent about 11 years of my life here. This is San Diego. That's San Diego Harbor. That's Point Loma. And you'll notice that for those of you that understand that, there's a border right here. There's an international border. I think the president's down there today or somewhere around in Arizona. So, but this shows you the distribution, or not distribution, but it shows you the vector field of currents off the coast of Mexico and the United States. We share this. We have the same problems. We're dealing with the same environment, and we're putting pollutants or not putting pollutants. The Tijuana watershed is a problem for both sides of the border. It's a security issue, it's an environmental issue, it's an economic issue. So regional models that bring nations together across borders are extremely important. We fight over fish, we fight over water, we fight over air, we fight over sea routes, we fight over entrances in and out of ports, that sort of thing. Okay. So what is GEO? Hopefully I've encouraged you to think about why observing is good. Now what's going on? What is GEO, the Group on Earth Observations? It's an organization dedicated to developing and doing a global Earth observing system of systems, or GEOS, which I'll talk about in a minute. But in essence, it's trying to capitalize on the fact that this is information that's needed for everyone. It's needed for all countries. It's needed for all citizens. It is not something that should be hidden, be part of some kind of a conspiracy. It's information that allows us to live. 6 billion people on this planet, maybe going to 9 billion. And some days we don't do very well. We need the information. It's only going to work if it's built with government, academia, international, and there's more pieces you can put in here. But it is more, think of it more than just a government organization. Right now, that's how it has begun. But we have the Alliance for Earth Observations. We have a group of both academic and major private industry now involved in supporting the development of instrumentation and the ability to be able to provide much more than government could provide. But government needs to provide the international aspects of it. How do we cross borders with this thing? If you want to know more, there's earthobservations.org. There are a number of websites which you can go to. But essentially, it right now is, and I think it's on the next slide. Let me go to it. Yeah. It was created after the World Summit in 1992, and the G8 meeting, in 2002, the Johannesburg Summit. And then from the next G8 meeting, if you look at the documents that were actually both summits, the World Summits, 1992, 2002, Rio and Johannesburg, what you will find when you look at all of the things that are needed to make developed nations out of developing nations, or raise the standards of nations which are not to our level, and we'd like to see them there. It all comes down to having the right information. Every one of these things depends on having observations of what is going on. The G8 decided to make that a scientific initiative in 2002, and 2003, I guess 2003, and 2003 in July, the Earth, U.S. invited 34 members, mostly people that were interested. And it turned out all of the European nations were interested, all of the developed nations were interested, and 20 international organizations, meaning UN organizations, to come to Washington. It was an invitation from the president. Colin Powell hosted it. And by the way, Colin Powell, does anybody know what his background is in training? He's a geologist. So he's an earth scientist. He's very interested in this personally, which I found fascinating because I hadn't spent much attention, although I worked for him for several years, I hadn't realized that fact that he's a geologist. And so he was very interested in this from his academic background. But we had five cabinet members there who were supporting this, and as I said, including Colin Powell. We got 34 nations to agree to set up an ad hoc GEO. So it began with 34 nations, 20 international organizations like the World Meteorological Organization, the FAO, UNESCO, the IOC, International Oceanographic Commission, or Council Commission, I guess. I forget the exact wording there. I know it makes a difference, but I'll leave that up to all you folks to straighten that out. Japan, we called that Earth Observing Summit 1. Out of that, we got an agreement from the nations that were there to set this organization up as an ad hoc group to come up with a 10-year plan. In Tokyo in April of 2004, the next meeting of the ministerial level was held. It was Prime Minister Koizumi was the host of that one. There were 47 nations now that had joined, plus the EC, the European Commission, and now up to 26 international organizations. By February of 2005, or 2 years later, when we had built the 10-year implementation plan, we were in Brussels, we were up to close to 60 members, 34 UN organizations, and the 10-year implementation was agreed upon. That ministerial agreed to make the organization permanent, to set up a secretariat in Geneva, which is where it is today, and then the plans are to have the next summit will be in November in Cape Town. The South Africans will host that summit. It's up to 69 members in the EC today, and now 46 international organizations. It's an interesting organization because it's not part of the UN system, but it represents a level playing field for all the UN organizations to come and sit down and talk to each other. Where can they talk to each other without being threatened? As they are inside the UN organization, they're always jockeying for money and position. And it's fascinating to listen to these people that are on there. Some of them have never talked to each other before. And if you don't, they run systems and they depend on systems to do their work, Earth systems. And so having them in this room, and they realize that they are participating members, they're participating organizations, not members. The nations are the members because they know they get their money from the nations. They know they get their money from the U.S. and Great Britain and Japan and Russia and whatever. All so there's two levels of hierarchy. The nations are members and determine what goes on, and the UN organizations there are participating and providing expertise and talking about how to deal with it. And the nations are there to help support it and provide the resources. So it's an interesting setup. And we're now engaged in working on this 10-year implementation plan. It'll take a lot longer than 10 years to create. Well, first of all, it exists today. There is already a global Earth observing system of systems. We have this. I've showed you what the satellite system looks like. Lots of nations have tide gauges, not all of them. Lots of nations report high altitude weather because they have weather balloons. So there's lots of things that go on out there. But the idea is to make this robust and finally to share information. It is easy to set up the technical part of this, relatively speaking, but how do you get people to agree to exchange data? Right now, India will not give us tide gauge data because they think for some reason that's giving away a military secret. And we have a lot of ways to figure out what tide gauge information looks like, but it would be really nice, particularly if you want to warn of a tsunami. That's the only way to get real-time information on a water level change. So We're working on that, but this is a hard thing to do. Other nations sell their data. New Zealand, for instance, doesn't look at it as a public good like the United States does. They sell their information. So if they want to bring it to the world table, they have to figure out a new business model, a new internal national business model. And that's not easy. So part of this organization, the biggest part, is to try to get people to come together, to have standard protocols to the agreement of what to share, how to share it, and the real-time value of it. So that's the organization. GIOS, what is GIOS? This is what we say it is. It's comprehensive, so we're talking about everything. You can't have one system, so you say it's a system of systems. It has to be coordinated, as it says there. Coordinated, not integrated. I used the word integrated before. Coordinated is a nicer word from the international political perspective. Integrated means to them that you want to take over what they're doing. If they're just coordinating, then, gee, I still own the system, so it's okay. I can join in. But if you want me to integrate with you, that means you're going to make some demands on me that maybe I don't want to have. Sustain. We must sustain it. Part of this is trying to get appreciation from not only the world, but the United States, for that matter, that you can't play games with the funding of these instruments. If you want to really work on the climate problem, we have to have sustained climate observing instruments in place. And climate takes place over a long period of time. You're not going to get it in 3 months and come back with a dissertation for your master's thesis and say, here's what's happening in the climate. You need to have sustained records with the right level, degree of specification, and they have to be very, very, very fine-grained detail for climate because it's a very small signal. And if you don't sustain that over a long period of time, you don't have anything. An end-to-end system of existing systems, in-situ remote sensing. Space is the backbone. Without space, none of this works. You have to have the coverage. And you have to link it with the new systems that come into place. Okay, what are we doing? In the United States, we have something called USGEO, which is just the name for the interagency committee that works out of the White House for the president's science advisor under that rubric, so to speak. It has created a strategic plan that's on usgeo.gov. For those of you who are not aware of it or haven't seen it, it's worthwhile taking a look at. It talks about the whole gamut of benefits that one gets from this. There are six particular topics that we're trying to work on because you can't get funding for everything at once, as many of you in this room know. So we're looking at disasters. If there's one thing that unites the world, it is prevention and recovery from disasters. So most nations are willing to share data if it helps them understand, predict, and then recover from disasters. So that's we're going first there. Drought is another one. Drought is a huge driver. Agricultural systems mean an awful lot to most countries with security. Air quality, a huge issue from a health perspective and from an energy perspective. And then there's data management, land observation, and sea level, which are coming along. Those are the nine benefit areas that the world has agreed to put foremost in this plan for GEO, for the global system. So you say, well, why these nine? Well, those are the nine that everybody agreed on. You could put transportation. You could come up with your own taxonomy. But I can tell you, sitting negotiating with 100 organizations to come up with the right, it's not easy. Those of you who have tried it, this is not a lot of fun. So this is what we agreed to. It's signed up. Everybody agreed to it. Health, disasters, weather, energy, water, climate, agriculture, ecology, and biodiversity. And here, the space contributions, you can see some of the more spectacular ones. The hurricane discovery, here's three of them going at once here. There's Hurricane Katrina, which was pretty spectacular. One, I have that behind my desk in my office because that was a big storm, and it's worthwhile looking at. The California fires, you can see. Actually, we work with some of the Defense Department assets along with our satellites to determine where these fires are starting. So we can get early warning on fires now to fire crews that are out there. And we also have portable systems that go out and are there with the fire crews to get the information from the satellites, get the local information, create local weather models, and tell the firefighters when it's going to shift, when the rain's coming, what's going to happen in order to help them recover from the forest fires. So there's enormous benefit to these things. I want to get back to the information issue. This is an information system. Okay, this is an information system. It's designed to get information out. So one of the things that we want to announce in Cape Town, rather, for South Africa, is the implementation of something we want to call GeoNetcast. If we can start broadcasting this information, even the information that we have, comprehensively, totally, to everyone around the world, developing nations and developed nations, it's going to make a big difference. It's going to, we believe, be a demand draw for more, and it will provide kind of a platform for publicity of what's going on. So we have the United States, Europe, and China have already signed up to an agreement to provide communication satellites, which will take some bandwidth and broadcast this information that can be picked up by a standard dish connected to a computer. So for $500 to $1,000, you'll be able, anybody can get a terminal to pick up this information. It'll be cheap to do for developing nations, and it'll be easy to do for citizens and anybody that needs this information for their own use. And the Russians are interested. They want to sign up for it. And Japan is also involved in it. Really haven't signed. So we will have we will cover the world. We will have geostationary satellites, communication satellites around the world that will be broadcasting the information that we have today in standard formats, common protocols. It'll be easy to achieve and easy to receive, rather, and easy to use. And that is, I think, one of the most important achievements so far from the organization. I'm going to close with information access. Really means enhance environmental and economic security. It's economic security. You may ask, why does this thing work? Why is everybody signed up to this? Because it's a voluntary organization, after all, and it's a win-win situation. No country can observe the entire Earth, yet the information each country needs comes from the entire Earth. Each country provides data to get the picture of the Earth, and most people catch on to that. It's a simple concept, and it's a win-win. You come to the table. You don't have to bring necessarily equal resources, but whatever you have from your section of the world, we'd like to know what it is. And by the way, we will help you with capacity building to provide sensors to get the right kind of information. And then we will distill back to you not just raw radiances, tables from satellites, but processed information. You tell us what level you want it at, and we'll give it to you at that level. And you can see we get. So you can get enhanced food security, economic security, energy consumption, alternative sources, health security, disaster preparation, infectious disease prevention. You see some tourist boats here. We believe at this point we have all the developed nations, and we have about half that group is developing nations. At this point, it's trying to get the developing nations into this organization to provide the benefits of it. Just an economic fact on the way out. This actually is a very old fact, but it's from about 6 years ago, published in USA Today. Basically, if you could improve the accuracy or cut the margin down of weather forecasting 1 degree, temperature 1 degree, you could save $1 billion alone in the United States by the way you managed our power plants. When you put gas turbine generators on, which are very expensive because you find out at the last minute, how you store fuel, what kinds of fuel mechanism, fuel buying and storage mechanisms do you have. And over here is an interesting shot of this called the seismic cube. Now, wouldn't it be nice if we could really tell how much oil the world has today? You know, you can't do that, okay, for those of you that work on that problem. You'll see, find out how much oil the world really has. The peak theory keeps moving. You know, we keep getting further and further. We'll run out eventually. I'm not saying we've got an endless supply of oil, but this is called a seismic cube. Some oil companies are working on this, and we have USGS working on it. You could, if you characterize the Earth and you made that data available, we could figure this out and have it for the world. It's an interesting thought. So in the end, benefits: right information, right format, right time, right people to make the right decisions. Leaders of nations, leaders of industry, leaders of their communities, down to average citizens. Everybody can benefit from this, developed nations and developing nations. We're very bullish on it. We think it's a good concept. We have 18 agencies that are involved in it, three of which are White House agencies, including OMB. It's always good to have OMB with you when you're working on something like this. And that's it. Thank you very much. And if anybody wants to ask any questions, I've still got time. That's how much time you have. Or anything you want to talk about. Anything else? Anyone want to talk anything else about NOAA or any other issues of the day are fine too.
What's been your most satisfying accomplishment at NOAA?
I don't know. I think the first Earth Observing Summit was probably pretty satisfying, but there's been a lot of just last year. I worked for 5 years on the Northwest Hawaiian Islands National Marine Monument. That was the single largest act of conservation ever in the history of the world, and that happened last year. That is a 1,200-mile area. It's preserved a section of the world from destruction and for perpetuity under the leadership of the United States. It was an enormous, never get picked up in the paper. You know, you've heard my reason why is that I have worked for both sides of the aisle over my career, and the Democrats never get any respect for national security, and the Republicans never get any respect for the environment. That's the stereotype, and that's the way that things work, but I can assure you that they're much closer than that. I have great respect for the Democrats for national security, and the Republicans are not all trying to trash the world. So you never got to see that because it just didn't get the right level of publicity, but that was an enormously satisfying. Yes, sir. Well, the Naval Academy spends a good deal of time trying to work on leadership, so they have leadership courses, and they make midshipmen be in charge of things. So as a senior first class, as they call them, the brigade supposedly runs the organization. And I had the opportunity to run a couple of organizations as a first class midshipman. And if you can get your peers to do something, that's a good test. It's easy now. I don't have a lot of gray hair, but I have some gray hair. And I have people that work for me that are very young and idealistic. But in those days, I had to deal with another bunch of smart Alex like me to try to get them to do something. So that was a very instructive lesson in leadership, to get a group of your peers. What's that? That was an extraordinary experience. I do consider myself a scientist. I'm trained as a scientist, and I learned not so much about leadership, but about the necessity for seeking the truth, whatever it is, and that you need to speak up, and you need to investigate things, and you need to look very carefully and never accept anything. If you can't prove it, it's a matter of faith. And I'm not against faith. What I'm against is people thinking they understand something and they're really taking it on faith. And you can see that in the newspapers every day. So this idea of trying to really, what do you really understand and what is the truth? And it's hard to find the truth in many cases. Not an easy problem. But anyway, those are... Yes, sir.
I commend your leadership on the GEOS initiative. What kind of
Well, you could argue that the whole NASA, NOAA, and a lot of EPA and Interior's budgets are into it, because if you look at what NOAA does in terms of observing the Earth,
you could claim, depending on how you want to do it, a half to two-thirds of our budget really are, and it's a $4 billion budget, are involved with observing, and that information isn't made available to the world. So we contribute just by being, essentially. Now, if you want to ask how much extra have we put in, then the United States put in $100 million at the first Earth Observing Summit, and we have this year $123 million for ocean science and ocean observing, which is basically contributes to the world system on understanding and working on the oceans. So I would, you know, several hundred million probably at this point when you look at pieces that are in various parts of the organization.
Again, on the leadership thing, who are the other countries' leaders equivalent to you?
We have in the organization there were four co-chairs that were set up, four nations co-chairs that were set up. And basically from the EC picked up the European part of the world, so the EC leader steps in. And basically it's the commissioner of R&D, research and development, that does that. This is my counterpart. The counterpart from South Africa is their director general for research and development in their organization, in their hierarchy. And when it began, it was Japan, and it was a deputy minister of MEXT that did it. And now it still is. It's just a different person. And in China, you have the deputy of the China Meteorological Organization and the what do we call the space? This is a space group. Well, Jax is Japan. I'm going to China now, because China is now one of the co-chairs. CMSA, but also the minister, Minister Xu, who is the head of their... Most is the word I'm looking for. Most. So they're the sponsors of... they're the sort of the main sponsors. And if you look at the other countries, you'll see a mix of people. Environmental ministers and meteorological, ocean related kinds of things like NOAA or the National Weather Service or Ocean Service. Those are the kinds of people. Sir?
You mentioned many other countries want to sell their information. With this diverse group, what's your experience with other countries contributing resources to the effort?
Actually, a lot of countries have contributed resources. Remember, I didn't explain this, but the business model of this organization is that countries contribute to a small secretariat that keeps the lights on and does the printing and sends out the mail and all that. The countries do the work, and the countries do the funding of the systems from their own resources or provide them to the UN organizations that do it. So it's not a UN organization where we contribute a whole bunch of money and then the organization decides how to give that money back out to the systems. The agreements are made up front that you'll do this and we'll contribute this. So the agreements are built in kind, basically, instead of in money. And we've found that many countries, even countries that are not, will contribute bucks to support the secretariat because it's relatively cheap to keep that going and they can afford... You know, there's no dues. It's an organization at will. Okay.
You mentioned about the overall governance model for GEOS. It's very effective. But how do you go beyond GEOS? And as Vincent sort of implied or hoped to apply the same kind of governance
I think eventually, this is probably not a position of the U.S. government at this point, but I think that this should become a U.N. function at some point, function of the General Assembly or whatever. I mean, it should probably turn into an international organization. And from there, I don't know. I mean, you have to go with the progress of what people will be willing to agree to. And I see it evolving. I don't see a final end state to this. I see it will continue to work because we're doing it. We were doing it before this organization came up, and you're just getting a way to to formalize things that are already going on and do them easier, and we'll come up with better mechanisms as it works through the system. But that would be the next step, make it a UN organization. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I just wanted to clarify that this system is providing information and data, but it's not fusing the data. Nobody's fusing the data to make any predictions. Because I was just thinking that this seems to be a business opportunity for somebody to make the prediction, you know, insurance companies or even companies to do political risk analysis. I just wanted to clarify that just providing the information and not actually fusing anything.
When I say we, the people who sit around, you know, people in the organization foresee a very important role for private industry, just like we have a private weather industry in this country that does things and provides markets. I think that that you see today some fusion. When you look at the meteorological picture that we present, if you go to UMetSat's headquarters or you go to our website, you're going to see some fusion of data. So it is not a clean cut where it's just all separate pots, but you're not going to see a fusion of data to the point where it's going to be useful necessarily to insurance companies or individual farmers or whatever. You're going to see, I think, industry figuring out how to deal with this, because the government's not big enough to do it, doesn't have the expertise, and in many cases shouldn't be doing it. It should be a market system that feeds off of this as it does today in the United States. Yes, sir.
Do you think some next steps that could be taken to at least get GPS and space navigation and remote sensing and all of these things working together more effectively?
Absolutely.
Extending your model?
I'm with you. Geomatics. I mean, I think this is I see this going, into health databases, into all sorts of issues, not just looking at the temperature of the atmosphere, for instance. The power of this is bringing together all of the various layers that you could put together from, and navigation is a huge, GPS precision location is critical to this concept. So yes, absolutely. And you have things like Google Earth today, and now Microsoft's trying to set up a network for information. I think there's a lot of interest in looking at what happens when you fuse this information, what happens when you can bring it to a larger network.
So you're seeing more of a commercial model through Google.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's there and ripe for the picking. I don't have enough time to work on it today. I would push it further if I had the opportunity. I think this is a huge area to work in and be very valuable.
Yes, ma'am.
Brazil, India, and China have cooperation agreements signed for the development, manufacturing, and launching of remote sensing satellites. What significance do those agreements have in this environment of collaboration of NOAA and other organizations?
I support all of the cooperative agreements. I think that space is a very expensive part of our portfolio, and that if you're going to be efficient worldwide, it's useful to have agreements where you can share launch facilities or share buses or satellites and look at cooperative agreements to be able to share data. Instead of putting up three satellites, put up one or two and then share the information. Again, it's hard to work across national boundaries because of intellectual property rights, tax situations, the individual egos of the nations involved, that we want to have our own. If we don't have ours, we don't consider that we're man enough to do this anymore. I mean, there's a lot of things that. But part of this is not to say that everything has to be initially a worldwide agreement for all, what it is, 70 nations now roughly involved in this. But there's room for collaborations inside of this at lower levels that work their way up to the top. So you can start with just two or three countries, and then you join in. You don't have to have everybody approve every agreement. It's a playing field where everybody can work on an equal basis.
I have one question.
Yeah, sure.
I guess when you first discussed and tried to sell this GEO or GEOS concept to the administration, that was difficult somehow. Or was that easy? And how did you convince the administration to go for a new multilateral system, basically?
Yeah, it's not easy. That, first of all, it's very hard. First of all, it's hard to get money. It's hard to get anything done. I think everybody in this room realizes that. I like one-on-one diplomacy. So I just went after people one by one until I got... And I think when you go to try to approach a group, you're playing Russian roulette, because you can have a herd mentality take over where one person may have some view and then everybody's afraid to. But if you can talk to people by themselves and you get them away from distractions and have a meaningful dialogue, you can work this. So I just worked each White House advisor that I could find one at a time. And then pretty soon, most of them, when they heard this idea, well, that's a good idea. You know, well, let's do that. So we finally got enough people to say, let's do that, starting with my own boss. I mean, I had to work up my own. Don Evans, who was the Secretary of Commerce at that point, was a supporter. And he's a good supporter to have because he's a friend of the president. I mean, so you look for the right supporters and you try to work them. I mean, that's my view on how to do that. But I thought you were going to ask a different question. The other thing, when I sold the idea, I'm going to use the European idea of GMES, which I didn't bring up, Global Monitoring for Environment and Security, GMES, which was a European concept that was introduced to me early in my tenure by Jose Ashash and by Vincent, for that matter. And it was an intriguing idea, and I thought about that. That was one of the pieces that went into, and telling people, well, there's already people, the Europeans are already doing it. You want the Europeans to get ahead of you? Oh, well, that would be horrible. The French?
So, you're missing the point about the Europeans are saying, hey, you know, the Americans are doing the geo. We have the...
There's a little bit of that in here, too. Yeah, you're trying to create a little envy that helps to ratchet the system up. Yeah, no, it's all All right. Yes, sir. Let's go. NPOs, remember, went through a Nunn-McCurdy restructuring last June. It has been working on a year-by-year basis. The new schedule has reduced the risk in it. It's taken off some instruments, and it's extended the time, and it's provided more money. So given all that, yes, they're making... Barely, but they're making it. Okay, so NPOs is working. I mean, it's not done till it's done. So, but right now, that's fine. So I'm not all that concerned about NPOs. I think it's, if it's not at the final configuration and final cost and schedule, it's darn close, given where it is its location in the acquisition profile from R&D to launch. GOES-R is obviously at a much earlier time, and we're hoping to avoid the problems that we had with NPOs by looking at it now before we sign a major contract and make sure we're very realistic on our expectations for the technology. So hence we have tried to reduce risk in that program as well and change some of the milestones and make it possible to execute with the resources that we hope we're going to get. Obviously, that's still to come. We have a 2008 budget over on the Hill, and we're creating the 2009 budget right now. But both programs have had significant reappraisals of how much of an advancement and how fast that advancement can be made. And time will tell. I've been in the acquisition business a long time, and you go back and look at the history of our systems, most of them have cost twice as much as they were originally estimated to cost. And of course, when you're talking billions of dollars, that gets into, people get very emotional about that, those kinds of increases. And so I'm hesitant to make any great predictions, but we are trying as much as possible to ensure that GOES-R does not have to have the same kind of midterm correction that NPOs has gone through. Does that help? You go ahead and come back at me.
Just curious, if
National Academy's report as some kind of ammunition to perhaps get, you know, some more funding? Or
I think,
I know that's been really recent, but
yeah, no, that helps. It helps to have other sources outside of the government, outside of me, because I'm considered parochial, obviously, since I'm attached to the agency. It helps to have outside independent views. And that report, it makes my life miserable, but I think it will help in terms of getting and getting support for what I would call the right level of investment for these issues, which I'm a passionate advocate for. Yes, sir.
General, your Department of Commerce just issued a new policy regarding media content.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if you think that was necessary. How necessary was it?
I think it was necessary because the problem that we had was when people get antsy about what scientists are saying or what policymakers are saying, not necessarily scientists, they go back and say, well, what does the instruction say? What does the policy say? So, you know, a year and a half ago, somebody went back and looked at the policy and said, oh, we better enforce this policy. And the policy required everybody to check in all the time. Well, if you check in all the time, then you think you're being muzzled. And that's kind of dumb. The policy was doing that, not the way we were actually operating. It was a knee-jerk reaction that went on for a few weeks or a month or so. And all of the incidents that now are being headlined are mostly coming from that period. And I said to my chain of command, this is kind of really, this is really dumb. You can't, this policy is not, the policies that we had were 25 years old. There were three different ones. They were unworkable. You didn't have enough people. They were just not realistic policies. And trying to make a realistic policy was really hard. And it took a long time. It took about 10 months to try to get everybody together. And the Commerce wanted to have one for the whole organization. And you have to realize that Commerce is bigger than a couple of climate scientists at Princeton or Boulder. Commerce gives out the GDP figures. And they have to have integrity, and they have to have control of passing out when you put out the numbers, who puts them out, who certifies them, and all that. So Commerce is an area that has to have integrity, and does. I mean, it does have integrity, and it's got to have a system. And every organization needs some kind of a system so that they can ensure that it's that people are working together. And trouble is, it gets blamed on a couple of people who couldn't talk to a reporter on the same day they wanted to talk to the reporter because they had to check in the system. So we've gotten rid of that. If you want to talk to the reporter, talk to the reporter. Just come back and tell us, and try to stay in your area of expertise. Don't you know, ascribe things to the president or to it's a scientific issue. Obviously, you publish it. Peer-reviewed science operates on its own. There's no there's no need to deal with that. But if you want to make a major press announcement, hold a press conference, and bring in the whole world, then you should probably check in with the organization. So, I mean, this whole thing is being blown out of whack. But the new policy, there will be people that take exception to this policy. But we sent it back and forth to our scientists three times. And we changed it the Commerce Department. We were able to get the Secretary, Deputy Secretary to change this. And I think it's a pretty reasonable. I think it's a pretty reasonable policy. You can argue with things in it, but by and large, most of our folks are happy. One, that they've been consulted, that we've allowed them to weigh in and tell the hierarchy what they didn't like about it, and then there have been a lot of changes made to try to deal with everybody's personal sensitivities from the point of having to have exact numbers for the Commerce Department figures, all the way down to somebody that's running a new model on the hurricane development at Princeton, for instance. Does that help help a little bit?
Maybe your last question. Anyone?
I think everybody's ready to go for an afternoon coffee break, right?
Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much, Admiral Tenbacker, for this presentation. It was really good. I think you have opened up the eyes of many people, including John Emery, there, who stayed till the end of the presentation, and who was, I think, puzzled and astonished by the amount of integration and coordination that we are trying to achieve with the GIOS. And clearly, this is something that we should all have in mind for the future of different space endeavors. And as you know, as you might know, we at CSIS will try to get more involved in remote sensing to become advocate about this activity, because we believe it's key and it's associated with both international and national security as well. So we'll try to get more involved, and because we believe it's very important and we cannot ignore it any longer. So please join me to thank another
conductor. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Very, very, very nice of you.